pilgrimage routes. Hello, I'm Richard Howard. I'm a barrister at Thurtown Essex Chambers.
And I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Council at Wedlake Bell.
And we are absolutely delighted today to have with us Dr. Emma Wells. Emma is a leading architectural historian and the technical director of SLR Consulting. Emma's with us today to discuss her book, Pilgrimage Routes of the British Isles, a revised edition of which is being published in paperback early in January 2025. Emma, welcome.
Thank you.
Start first of all, but just what is pilgrimage?
Yes, it's a good question, really. And I suppose it means lots of things to lots of different people. I suppose we tend to think, also the majority of people tend to think of pilgrimage as a very religious or spiritual undertaking. And of course, it does have those connotations, and I'll come on to those. But pilgrimage can simply mean a journey to a place that holds some sort of resonance to one. Of course, the sort of official definition, though it's acquired different meanings for different purposes, for different cultures over the years, over the centuries. But it means journeying, peregrination to a specifically religious site for a specifically religious purpose. Often you have to technically have an overnight stay at some sort of pilgrimage centre or whatever you want to call it. But the reason that I'm sort of giving you lots of different definitions is it's changed, it's evolved over time. If we go back to the original definition in the sort of medieval era, canon law defined it as a mandatory journey that one would have to undertake as penance for wrongdoing. And also people would take voluntary acts, would have it as a voluntary act as well, which involved a preliminary vow. In fact, some people even hired people as well to go on pilgrimages for them as penance for a wrongdoing. So it's sort of just a journey for a specific purpose. And I know that sounds a little bit odd, but that's sort of what it has come to mean. In the medieval era, you would often also have a specific attire. You would have the pilgrim hat, the pilgrim scrip, the pilgrim staff. And then when you went to your different sites, you would acquire pilgrim badges as a sort of token of I was here sort of thing. And yeah, so it's just come to mean a sort of spiritual journey.
What's a scrip?
A scrip is a little leather bag that you put your things in.
How much is it the destination? How much is it the journey that makes a pilgrimage?
It's a bit of both, really. If you are undertaking the pilgrimage for reasons of penance or wrongdoing, or even, I suppose, spiritual enlightenment, the journey can be as much as important as the end location. In the medieval period, I would argue it's a bit of both, really, because you are undertaking that sort of arduous journey. But it's very important, it's as important, even perhaps more important, is the end journey, which will usually be a shrine of X saint at X church or cathedral. And in addition to that, you'll have various different sacred sites along the way, you see. So you will be going and probably staying in pilgrim churches, often in porches pilgrims would stay. But you might be visiting X saint at a local parish church on the way. You might be visiting the holy well of another saint along the way, and then you're making it to your grand cathedral or something like that. But it's probably important to point out at that then that I think we think of these great big long tortuous journeys across the channel, or even for myself, if I was going to Canterbury or somewhere like that, but they were actually once-in-a-lifetime experiences. So particularly in the medieval era, I'm talking, most pilgrims would journey to their local saint, so to their local parish church, and that would still be seen as an act of pilgrimage. They're doing it for penance or something to get rid of sins, whatever it might be. But those very grand pilgrimages were, as I say, once in a lifetime. You didn't have annual leave from work. You didn't have pay for that or anything. So they were very much once in a lifetime.
Can I ask how indulgences work?
So effectively, you would, I suppose it's the same thing as doing a pilgrimage, really, is you are going somewhere or you are visiting a certain site. And as a result, you get often 40 days free from penance, etc. So the problem obviously then we come to the Reformation and indulgences were outlawed and all this sort of thing. And the problem with this is you are effectively buying penance. You're effectively buying time through purgatory to heaven. You are buying getting rid of sin. You are not really, you might be undertaking a pilgrimage to do it, but you're essentially buying your wrongdoings to get to heaven. So that's why it became such a problem. But it was a real moneymaker, as was pilgrimage, and I'm sure we'll come on to that. But these were real moneymakers for the church in the medieval era. And to be perfectly honest with you, why we have such grand cathedrals, Gothic cathedrals and earlier, it's because of pilgrimage and indulgences, really.
I was going to suggest it was sort of the business model to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the way I can sort of convey is we can think of it as akin to modern theme parks pilgrimage, really, and the cathedrals at the end, because the cathedrals were constantly vying to have the best saint, the most popular saint, and the highest number of saints as well, their relics. If they had a great saint's relic, whether it was the true cross or at Durham, it was St. Cuthbert, obviously Thomas Becket, at Canterbury, that attracted a lot of pilgrims, that attracted a lot of visitors. On one year at Canterbury, it was 100,000 visitors. So, I mean, that is a lot of people, and they are providing offerings, they're giving offerings in return for visiting that saint. And therefore, that effectively funded the development of those cathedrals. When they wanted a new east end, they might add a new relic into the church, they might update their shrine, they might create pilgrim routes around the actual cathedrals. So it was all a money-making enterprise, and they were really sort of trying to outdo the Joneses, keep it with the Joneses, or outdo. I mean, Durham and Canterbury had a huge rivalry in the medieval period. Cuthbert was number one before Thomas Becket was murdered. And they were, throughout the centuries, you can see that they were constantly trying to outdo one another through their buildings. So there you go.
So what's the story of St. Cuthbert and the St. Cuthbert's Way, which is one of those you cover in your book?
So this is a really interesting pilgrim route, I think. So St. Cuthbert was a monk on Holy Island, Lindisfarne, as well as Innerfarne Island, which is just down the coast from there. He died on Lindisfarne. Well, actually, he died on Innerfarne, and his body was brought to Lindisfarne. It was buried in the priory there. And then when the Viking raids occurred, the monks from the priory wandered, is the official word for it, wandered his body around the north. We don't entirely know for how long. Some people say 100 years, some people say 7 years, so we still don't know for sure. But they wandered it as far south as Crake in York, at Ripon apparently as well. So they wandered his body around trying to find somewhere to put him. And that's eventually how they ended up in Durham. There's a whole Dun Cow, a theory associated with it, hence Dun Elm, Durham, etc. That's where that sort of comes from. In that they saw, I think it was a milkmaid, I can't remember the official story because there's so many different ones, but it's something to do with a cow. And she said the cow was up there and the coffin wouldn't move where they saw the cow, hence they built the cathedral there. There is a little milkmaid and cow on the sculpture on Durham Cathedral, if you're ever there on the north elevation. But as a result, that meant that there were two very interesting and sacred sites associated with St. Cuthbert, because you had his burial site at Lindisfarne, and then you had his where he was reinterred in Durham Cathedral, and they sort of built the cathedral around him, if you will. And the reason for this is that when saints are buried or they inhabit or touch or anything similar to that, a site, an object, etc., their power, their efficacy when it comes to healing and all that, their healing power, it's felt, or it's safe, or their sacrality, I suppose, is felt to be imbued with the object, the site that they have touched, that they have been interred in. And therefore, that's why the Lindisfarne burial site was seen as just as important as his actual burial site where his body was at Durham Cathedral after it had been moved. So pilgrims were essentially undertaking the journey of his body, going to Holy Island as his final resting place. But they started at Melrose Abbey. That's where the pilgrim route starts, is Melrose Abbey. Technically, today it's Melrose Abbey. It was Old Melrose where he started his vocation, if you will, as a monk. And so the route travels sort of straddles the borders between England and Scotland and takes in quite a lot of sites associated with St. Cuthbert. So ends where he was buried, starts where he started his career. And in between, you can find everything from St. Cuthbert's Cave, which is another place that his body was left, where it stayed for a while when the monks were sort of on their travels as well. That's not far from Lindisfarne and other associations along the way. But also, a lot of these routes have acquired sites. And what I mean by that is, if you walk St. Cuthbert's Way, for example, the sites that you will visit are not just sites associated with Cuthbert now. They're associated with different saints or places of spirituality and also places of tourism as well. So this is how these routes merge and evolve over time into a little bit more centered around tourism too.
If we're thinking of St. Cuthbert's Way, how far can we trace what the medieval route was and how far is what we have now a modern reconstruction?
We can't. I tried for several years, effectively. I started out writing a journal article, trying, which is sort of where the book came from, actually. I tried doing this once for a paper for the British Archaeological Association. And the more I tried doing it, the more difficult it was really to unpick, because they just didn't quite marry up. But what I do talk about in the book is this, is how historically accurate are these routes? And what I found really is they are slightly accurate and they do follow some of where medieval pilgrims would have trodden, but they have evolved into ways that we can actually walk, obviously trackways that are safe for us to walk and around areas that you can visit, whether it's for tourism purposes or just stay overnight or all those sorts of things. So that's why pilgrim routes have evolved into these modern tourist trails. And obviously the landscapes have evolved since the medieval era as well. So it's very difficult to trace where they went. We don't have any documentary evidence for pilgrimage on the what would be the St. Cuthbert's Way. There is actually evidence for pilgrimage to Lindisfarne and to Innisfarne Island. There's talk in the, I think it's the 14th and 15th century, of pilgrims using the boat to get to Innisfarne and things like that, and giving offerings around Lindisfarne. So that's as much as we have. But actually trying to trace the route is nigh on impossible, really.
Two of the routes you discuss in the book are routes from Winchester, so my sort of home patch these days. Why Winchester, for starters?
I think this again goes back to why do pilgrim routes become the routes that they do? And it's for this reason is, of course, Winchester Cathedral was home to the Shrine of St. Swithin, a very important shrine site, which went back to the House of Wessex. So we're going back to the early English Anglo-Saxon era, even before the sort of real height of pilgrimage in the 14th century, really. Well, 11th to 15th, arguably. But even before that, St. Swithin was a very important site of pilgrimage. It's the capital, the House of Wessex is obviously at Winchester. So it's effectively England's capital at this time. Therefore, that's why we start at Winchester. But then it leads the way to the former site of St. Thomas Becket's shrine and tomb at Canterbury Cathedral. And of course, as well, we have the mention in 14th century Canterbury Tales. And then we have Julia Cartwright's mentioned as well. And so many different documentary accounts of doing this way. Now, the reason for this is that there was a pilgrim's way, a pilgrim's road, a routeway that was very commonly walked, a well-trodden routeway between Winchester and Canterbury. And that goes for quite a few of the routes that are mentioned in my book. Not all of them by any means, but the routes in Cornwall, you see this a lot, and in the southeast, you see this a lot. They were routes that were traversed by drovers, and they were former drovers' ways. Some of them were even ancient ways as well. And it was the ways that were the most, I suppose, the safest, the easiest, and would get you from A to B, would get you to the most important places in that particular era. And of course, Winchester and Canterbury were so important at that time. So that's why Winchester became such a hub really for pilgrimage. I mean, the Pilgrim's Way really was once one of the most important routes in the entire country. Yes, for pilgrimage, but also just for getting from A to B as a safe route way that one could travel without being, I don't know, taken over by marauders or whatever might happen to you, as well as animals, dangerous animals. We have to think about all of this when you're a medieval pilgrim walking along the route. So that's why. And we do have cartographic and documentary evidence as well. So the Pilgrim's Way is far easier to trace than any of the actual routes as well. You can see them on many of the earlier maps as well, the Goth map, etc. So we do know that people were traversing this way for centuries.
Were pilgrim routes ever chosen, do you think, just for the beauty of the scenery and the sort of spiritual effect that might have? Thinking about the St. Andrew's Way, it just strikes me as absolutely lovely. Having read your book, I'm very excited to actually walk the St. Andrew's Way.
Yes. Now, I think there's sort of two answers to that. Is, do I think they have become that? Yes, absolutely. So I think because there is some historical grounding in all of the ways that are featured in my book, that's true. But as I mentioned, they have kind of morphed into tourism routes, and they therefore have been created by modern wayfarers who have traversed these routeways for several times. They know the landscape, they know the important sites, they know the sites that people want to visit, they know where they should be staying, and they know the beautiful landscapes that people want to see and visit. So they have morphed into, yes, routes that people can take in, the environment, the atmosphere, whatever it might be. So absolutely. Do I think that was the case in the medieval era? Not as much, because it was more where you were going to on the way. And the importance there was perhaps, now, of course, it was the spiritual journey, but it was the ardour that you were going through in order to be forgiven of your sins and all the rest of it. So it certainly has morphed into that. Absolutely.
I'm really surprised, because I have always thought of pilgrims as poor. I'm surprised that it is such an important fundraising venture for the church.
Pilgrims were by no means just the poor. No, it's every level of society pilgrims were. So we have documentary evidence of pilgrim offerings. So they would have places to offer at near the relics throughout a church. So it might be an altar here, it might be the head of so-and-so here, the shrine of Becket and the Trinity Chapel in Canterbury. So the poorest of pilgrims would be offering and just providing little bits and pieces here and there. But the money, yes, if you had 100,000 pilgrims, it doesn't matter how poor they are. If you've got 100,000 bits of silver, you've got a lot of money. But we have a lot of documentary evidence as well. And that's mainly what we do have of the elite pilgrims. So at Durham, for example, we have a huge amount of recording of the nobles, etc., coming and giving, and how much they actually gave on X day or X year, which makes it very interesting when it comes to Durham, because there is a line of frostily marble at the west end of Durham's nave. And the sort of old adage is that Cuthbert was misogynistic and he didn't want women visiting his shrine in the east end. And therefore, women couldn't cross this line in the actual nave. There isn't much really to this, but there are few offerings that were given by women. And we know this because there was an elite woman who did manage to give an offering. And we can see this because we know who actually gave offerings. But was it given by her husband? That sort of thing. It's very interesting. But no, by no means was it that kings, queens, they went on many pilgrimages. Most of the medieval era and Tudor era, of course, until Henry VIII, they visited Canterbury, Durham, etc. They were going on pilgrimage. They did make offerings. Some of them, of course, were giving great big jewels. They encrusted the shrines with many great big jewels. Others were giving a lot of money to see shrines. A lot of the shrines were developed, were redone in the medieval era, the later medieval era. And so the elite pilgrims were given the money to do that. So all aspects of society. There were even some elite men, largely elite men, I don't think I've found any references to women, but who got people to go on pilgrimage in their stead. why, I suppose, you send your minion along, don't you, to go and do it for you. So there's instances of that. But then, yes, we have records of nobles as well as kings going on, and they brought their entourage. It was a great big progress. Some of them actually did go on pilgrimage during a progress. So yes, so it was a little bit of both, really. Does that mean it's pilgrimage? Interesting. Were they roughing it enough? Well, if they're coming along with a great big jewel, I suppose the ecclesiastics at the other end perhaps don't care.
We touched on the Reformation a couple of times. What's the effect of the Reformation? Did pilgrimage continue in the British Isles from that period?
It's an interesting one, is the Reformation. So Henry VIII comes along and he does outlaw saints, pilgrimage, etc. very early on in the Reformation era, he does. However, pilgrimage does continue in different ways. There's been quite a lot of research on post-Reformation pilgrimage in the early modern era. There is documentary accounts of people simply just going on pilgrimage still, because, of course, just because your king brings in the church in England, as it was, and outlaws all the Catholic smells and bells, that doesn't mean that you necessarily agree with that. And so you did have people that still went on pilgrimage. As I say, we have records of that. But then sort of what we end up with is far more spiritual pilgrimage, really. And particularly into the 16th and 17th century, well, 17th century more so, you see farm publications coming out about, I suppose, what we would call armchair pilgrimage as well. And people who could manifest a pilgrim in their mind, and you were still going on your spiritual pilgrimage, but through your mind in different ways. And what's also interesting about that is the labyrinths. So the labyrinths that were also on the floors of many cathedrals, the Chartres has one, for example, still. These were quite common in medieval churches too. And the labyrinth became a sort of place for this pseudo pilgrimage to occur. You would traverse the labyrinth and you'd been on your pilgrimage as well. So there were sort of lots of ways that people got around the injunctions that outlawed pilgrimage, and they did it in different ways effectively.
When pilgrimage continued, is there a sort of denominational aspect to that in terms of the split between Catholicism and the Anglican Church and the various Protestant churches? In terms of my sort of sense, I may be entirely wrong about this, is of saints and relics being very much a Catholic
thing. That's true. The majority, yes. Largely, it is a Catholic endeavour. However, it did migrate over into Protestantism. We do see there is evidence of that, particularly as you get on into the 18th, 19th century. And there is even a revival of pilgrimage. Anglo-Catholics, we can safely say that they were the ones who revived pilgrimage, and it really did see a sort of reflowering in the later 19th century, when not just pilgrimage was sort of revived, but also everything to do with the medieval era. I mean, hence why we get so many Gothic with a K or neo-Gothic churches and buildings, because the Middle Ages was seen as the epitome of religion, when everyone was the most devout and they were trying to aspire to get that back. Hence, pilgrimage becomes extremely popular again. And that's why sort of Walsingham in Norfolk has a real revival as well, the Shrine of Our Lady there too.
So how does the revival of pilgrimage from the 19th century people looking back to, or the Gothic, which is a huge influence on Victorian architecture and so on, how does that then continue to lead to the pilgrimage routes which we now have?
I think because there was such a revival and so many people were going on pilgrimage again, that there was a lot of research done and just a lot of interest in the original routes, the historical routes as it was. So I think we can say that the routes that we, and that are featured in my book, for example, they started to sort of form in the 19th century, because they certainly aren't the medieval versions of it, and they certainly aren't the 20th versions of it. But somewhere in the middle is when those routes began to form. And this sort of goes hand in hand as well with the birth of Romanticism as well, and the 18th and 19th century, when you had the start of tourism to the Lake District and to Yorkshire and to the borders and all that sort of thing. And you had the authors writing about these beautiful landscapes and their sacred pasts and their histories and the saints and all these sort of thing. So I think it all sort of goes hand in hand, and they started to form these routes. People started to walk them. they were easier to navigate at this point. You could get to the north, especially with the railway and that sort of thing. But it wasn't really, I mean, pilgrimage sort of had a little bit of another revival owing to the birth of railways and access to the coasts and those sorts of things and people going on walks, really. But it wasn't really until the later 20th century, really, the 80s and 90s, you see a huge amount of these routes being formed. And if you look through my book, when you see that they became the official routes, it was due to the drive for tourism. It was due to funding to create them. And there was a recognition that this would allow money to be injected into the local areas as well. So, as I said, it's a very interesting sort of evolution that we see over probably 100, 150 years.
And I suppose you got from the late 90s, first part of the 20th century, the movement towards access to the outdoors, access out of the cities, because so many people were living in the cities and the Kinder Scout mass trespass and so on in terms of that general countryside access. So part of it, leaning very side, the spiritual side, is the ability of people who are living in cities to get out and have a particular reason to do something or a particular route that's navigable.
That's it. I think you're right. I think that does start, as I say, with what I would argue is the birth of tourism in the later 18th century with Wordsworth and the poets that are going to the Northwest and that era and pre-Raphaelites and all that, because they could physically get there. They could physically see the landscapes. And then you do get, within the sort of later 19th and into the early 20th century, the sort of focus on antiquarianism and the antiquarians that are also carrying on this tradition, as often many of them were academics as well, and they were wanting to look into the roots. They were very interested in British history, what became, and writing down these roots as well and navigating them themselves. So yes, it all sort of was a perfect storm, really.
What's been your favourite pilgrimage? Have you ever undertaken any of these routes?
Well, as part of writing the book, I obviously have been along many of them, and I've undertaken bits and pieces of them all at different times. I think St. Cuthbert's Way is my favourite. I don't think I'm biased, but obviously I've done so much work on that area. St. Cuthbert and Durham Cathedral was one of the case sites in my PhD. I did some research on pilgrimage, later medieval pilgrimage to Lindisfarne. So after Cuthbert's body had been moved to Durham, I was very interested in the pilgrims going back up to the north, to the borders, and was there any evidence of that? And yes, and in fact, what was so interesting I found as part of the research was that on Lindisfarne and Inner Farne, the few monks that left, there were some that went back after the Viking raids and they were still in the priory, etc. They restored Cuthbert's original cell where he lived on Inner Farne and St. Cuthbert's Isle, which is just off Holy Island. All the bits and pieces that were associated with St. Cuthbert, they restored them because they were ruins before this, and it was due to pilgrimage. So they clearly saw that there was a need to have these sites readily available for pilgrims coming. And of course, they were bringing offerings with them. So they weren't stupid about doing that. So as I say, this is why I relate them to theme parks. It's like they have to rebuild. They have to have the great rides. They have to have the great attractions. And you can see this in the documentary accounts. They're putting money in to get a new boat, to get pilgrims across. They're putting money in to restore his cell. And it is 14th century. St. Cuthbert's cell is 14th century. It's not from his era. So it's extremely interesting that they did that too. So there is physical evidence of pilgrimage at that time. So I think that's why it's my favourite. Plus it's beautiful landscape. St. Cuthbert's Cave, or Cuddy's Cove as it's affectionately known, is a beautiful landscape. You can park at the bottom. It's only about a mile's walk or something just to this cave. You're just in the middle of nowhere and you think, gosh, Cuthbert's body once was here. It's just fantastic.
I think that sense of being in the middle of nowhere with a spiritual element to it can be quite dramatic, can't it?
Yeah, it's very evocative. It's very humbling, I suppose, as well. And whether you're interested in the spiritual aspect of it or the history, I think there's something for everyone, really. Pilgrim routes today are not just travelled by those undertaking a spiritual peregrination. It may just be simply for the history, the architecture, the landscape, and that's absolutely fine too.
The spiritual journey. And was it quite a social activity or taken alone?
It could be both. Of course, if you read Chaucer, it was quite a social activity for many. But then there would be others that were just on their own. If they really were wanting that torturous, arduous journey, they would be going alone with their pilgrim staff and scrip and all this sort of thing and making it alone and sleeping in porches and where they could, under trees, etc. So it depends what the purpose was, I suppose.
Do the pilgrimage routes have particular heritage value, do you think, in terms of if we're looking at particularly looking at developments or decisions that may affect those routes? Is there a particular value to the route as distinct from some of the particular locations, of course, like Durham and Winchester and Canterbury are immensely significant?
Absolutely. I mean, there is value, of course, whether historic, architectural, everything, communal, all the values really you can find in the pilgrim routes. And yes, Durham being a World Heritage Site, you see that because there is that universal value, that universal importance, significance, not just for the cathedral, which is a pilgrim station, an end spot to the pilgrims. Yes, it is. And there was a pilgrim route actually around the cathedral that pilgrims used to take as well, a specific route you would take. But also the landscape and the area surrounding the cathedral, its wider setting, forms part of an original historical pilgrim route. So the site itself has importance, has significance, the routes nearby have significance, and then it's group value with Lindisfarne and all the local churches and Chesterley Street, where Cuthbert's body formerly laid. So, yeah, absolutely. And most of the churches, whether they are World Heritage Sites or not, it's an interesting one, and sometimes it can be a bit of a sticky wicket because some churches were built prior to pilgrim routes ever forming. We have to remember that. And most churches were constructed prior to there being settlements. The settlements formed around the churches. And I think there is often, many consultants even make the mistake to say the church was put there because the settlement wanted it. Because of the way that the settlement was laid out, the church ended up there. I'm thinking, no, that's not the case. The church was there and the settlement grew around it, which is very common because churches were often put on sites of assembly that had been there back in even prehistory. So, of course, there is, however, still some sort of inherent significance because most of the churches ended up being on some sort of pilgrim route. So we have to look at that as part of the wider setting. Absolutely. Yeah.
Emma, thank you so much for your time. I had the hardback version of your book for many years and very much enjoyed looking at all the places it describes and so on. Looking forward to the paperback, which I know is revised, coming out in 2025. Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.